You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, more than 750 men wrote into the New York Times in response to a question asking if they'd ever felt regret for the way they treated girls or women in the past. We'll find out what men had to say. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. State Republican leaders are planning to limit the powers of the governor before Tony Evers takes office in January. A Superior shipyard is settling a lawsuit with employees, and this week could be the worst of the year for deer crashes. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. Rob, welcome back.
Why, thank you for having me back.
Well, let's get a little, we always love to have you back, Rob. Let's get into a little bit of post-election news. Democrats had not taken over any legislative seats. They got the governor's office and some other big wins, but not those legislative seats, except maybe there's one, a new result as votes were counted from the 14th Assembly District in the Wauwatosa area. What's going on?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, it looks like the Democrat Robin Vining is going to win that race after these late votes, as you mentioned. The official canvass won't be complete for a little while longer, but she's ahead now. And this was an open seat, had been held by Dale Koyenga, who ran and won his race for state Senate this year. And it's also, you know, it's Wauwatosa, right? So it's suburban Milwaukee. It's in Milwaukee County, a place that obviously saw a very high voter turnout in general and very large number of votes for Democrats. But it's like the suburbs. It's supposed to be a Republican area, or it certainly has been a heavily Republican area represented by a Republican. So this is like it's like an interesting result and shows some of the weakness, relative weakness that Republicans had in some suburban areas, as well as just a high turnout Democrats had in this election.
But Republicans will still have control over the Assembly and the state Senate. They expanded a bit despite winning all the statewide elections. And let's talk about what happens now. There could be a lame duck session to talk about the incentive package for papermaker Kimberly Clark. Now we're hearing from Republican leaders in both chambers. They may want to limit the governor's power in some ways before Tony Evers takes office. What are we hearing about that idea?
Right. Well, so, yeah, this is the big fight now. I mean, these statements from the legislative leaders, for obvious reasons, have gotten a lot of attention. It's a little hard to know because there's no legislation. There's not like a list of what they're proposing yet. But like they are out in public talking about it. You know, Wisconsin has had one party rule for a very long time, and so these Republican leaders, I guess, don't like the idea of having a Democratic governor. Among the things that might be changed, or what they say they might be looking at, ways to limit like what rules the executive branch can enforce through agencies. My guess is that the Department of Natural Resources is going to be a big part of that. That's a place where the executive branch can exert some power, and it's certainly an area where there are differences in between Democrats and Republicans and how that should go down. Another thing is appointments to the boards of the Department of Natural Resources, potentially the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, and even the UW system. Again, we don't know, but that's something that has been mentioned and is speculated about, is that maybe just for basically just raw partisan reasons, Republicans would rather not have a Democratic governor appointing as many positions or appointing, or who knows.
Some backlash to this, the idea of, okay, they're okay with a Republican governor having these powers and then changing them at the last minute before a Democratic governor. There's been some pushback here.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, do they care? You know, I mean, if they can do it, maybe they'll just do it. You know, the Assembly has a massive Republican majority and essentially no members who have shown an inclination to fight with the leader, Speaker Robin Voss. It's a generalization, but basically that is the case. The Senate, not so much. It's a much smaller majority, though. As you know, they've added a seat in these last elections. But there are some, like, actual Republican moderates. It's a little bit like the U.S. Senate in that way. So so it could be, it could end up being the case that what Republicans do on this has more to do with what measures Senator Jerry Petrusky or Luther Olson or a couple of others who are more in the middle of the caucus will support.
Looking at some of the top news of the week in Wisconsin with Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin. A quick look at this lawsuit we're hearing in the news, a settlement at a shipyard, Fraser Shipyards in Superior, involving lead poisoning for 60 of their employees. What was at stake here, Rob?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, this is a big employer up there in Superior, and these workers were exposed to lead as they were retrofitting, upgrading engines on one of these big Great Lakes freighters, these giant ships. This led to an investigation by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA. That started in 2016. The company was initially fined $1.4 million by OSHA for failing to protect these workers. And then there's a set of lawsuits filed by several groups of the workers. This is the final step. This settlement ends all of that. It this settles the workers' lawsuits. It also, as part of the settlement, the initial OSHA fine of $1.4 million is knocked down to $700,000. This should be the end of this process.
And then finally, Rob, we're always watching around for deer in Wisconsin when we're driving. This week is maybe the worst time. What do we know about this time of year and car deer collisions?
Yeah, be careful. So we know that the deer are active at this time of year as rutting season. And we also know that hitting deer is
dangerous
hazard. Yeah, it's a hazard all year long. But in 2017, so we crunched the numbers, General Sentinel crunched the numbers on this. In 2017, the worst day for car versus deer crashes was November 8th. The year before that, it was November 10th. So we are basically right in the middle of the most dangerous time of the year, and November is always the worst month.
And we're seeing the costs, in addition to the health risks, the costs of deer crashes go up over the years. Briefly, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because there are, you know, cars are safer than ever, and there are fewer fatalities, though not none. I mean, it can be serious, but meanwhile, the cost of the damage that's done has gone up.
We'll leave it there for now. Rob, as always, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much.
That's Rob Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, with us for our weekly look at news from around the state. The New York Times decided to put a call out to their male readers to search for a missing piece in the Me Too movement. They asked men if they had ever behaved toward girls or women in ways they've now come to regret. Within a week, they'd heard from more than 750 men. Alicia P.Q. Whitmire is the gender editor of the New York Times opinion section. She wrote and edited the stories of the piece, Eight Stories of Men's Regret. Executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson spoke with her last week about the responses.
Alicia, can you talk a little bit about what made you decide to do this project and ask men about things that they regret?
Yeah. The idea for this came about in the wake of the Christine Blasey Ford story, when she initially went public to the Washington Post with her accusations against Brett Kavanaugh. And so I think a couple of factors made it seem like a good idea at the time. So first, I think there was just kind of the sheer recognizability of what she was describing, and so many people responded to it with variations on, didn't everyone sort of act like this in high school? Everyone sort of had incidents like this. And so I think we thought, people are clearly hearing this and processing it through the lens of their own experiences. Like, let's see if we can dig into those a little bit and see if the way that they think about those experiences has changed. So that's kind of the immediate answer to why now. In addition to that, there was, I think, an appetite on the part of women to get some kind of indication that men are having some kind of response to the unusual moment we've been living through when it comes to, you know, these sort of nationwide conversations about sexual assault. So there's, you know, clearly two sides to all of these Me Too stories, and I think that we have only really heard one of them in a big way, and we, for whatever reason, it was been hard to get contributions from men that kind of match the rawness and the honesty of the way that women have been talking about their experiences. And so it kind of occurred to us that maybe asking our readers might be a solution to this. You know, maybe that there are stories out there that we just aren't hearing because, you know, we're asking writers to tackle the subject as opposed to just average people. So that was kind of what brought about the idea.
Well, and it was really interesting to me because you put this call out. You specifically said you were asking for stories of high school experiences from men that they feel some level of regret for. And you got a lot of responses really quickly.
Mm. Can I actually just add, so we didn't actually specify high school.
Oh,
I can say that we definitely asked readers in the context of what happened between Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh. So I think probably a lot of them had high school in mind.
Okay.
I'm not quoting the wording specifically, but it was something like, you know, have you ever behaved in ways that you regret towards women? But yeah, tons of them came in, and we kind of knew right away that we had gotten some good ones. I think we kind of immediately had a sense that these responses did have that kind of raw and honest quality that we've been trying so hard to get elsewhere. I was surprised in some ways. I wasn't surprised that so many people had these stories. I was surprised at how sort of candid they were and reflective they were when they were talking about them. And I would say it was kind of encouraging for me in some ways to sort of know that these nationwide conversations were having some kind of impact.
And so let's talk about the spectrum of responses, because you asked people, you decided that you would only share in the newspaper ones where people were willing to be named. And that's a really big step. But then there were also anonymous submissions. Tell us what of those that you chose to publish and those who were willing to be identified, what types of incidents are we talking about?
So of the ones that we chose to publish and the ones that were willing to be identified, so I think I mentioned in the intro to the piece that one thing that stood out to us as we were kind of going through and saying, here's what we have that we think we can publish. A lot of the men who said yes were older, either in retirement years or approaching them. And that stood out to me in part because when I had conversations with some of the people who had submitted responses that declined to attach their names, many of them cited their job as reasons that they didn't feel like they could do so, that they had too much to lose. One of them said, you know, we have a single income household. I can't attach my name to this. So that was one thing that stood out to me about the ones who did attach their names. It is fair to say that the ones that we could publish were probably on the milder end of the spectrum. So that's not to say that they didn't include some stories that were shocking to read people attaching their names to. So one man told his story of having driven to the top of a hill and to Mulholland Drive, actually, with a friend, and telling the girl that they were with she was walking home unless she agreed to expose her breasts and be fondled by them. That's a memorable event for that girl, I would say, probably. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, there's lots of coercive facets to it. On the other hand, the ones that we couldn't publish and the ones that people wouldn't attach their names to, I mentioned in the intro that there were a handful, not many, but a handful, that described participation in or observing gang rapes. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, really on the really far end of the spectrum. There were many situations that involved drinking gone wrong. In one instance, a man described how he had had sex with someone and realized later that she had been, you know, far too drunk to consent. One in which a man a boy, actually, because they were both 15 at the time. So a boy was making out with a girl, and she had gone limp, and he considered, you know, going forward, though he did say he stopped. But I'm not quoting him exactly, but he had said something like, I remember this situation because it had all the bad possibilities. Mm. So that, I think, gives some sense of what didn't make it into the final piece, what people weren't comfortable attaching their names to.
We are talking with Alicia P.Q. Whitmire. She's the gender editor of the New York Times opinion section. She wrote and edited the stories of the piece called 8 Stories of Men's Regret. One of the things that really struck me, Alicia, is that these stories, while perhaps they have become more prominent for the men in the current Me Too movement, watching things like Christine Blasey Ford's testimony, some of these incidents deeply affected the men as well. I'm thinking of one of the older readers, Lee, who had been in the class of 1949, and he dropped out of high school because of shame for what he did when he was 17. And his story didn't actually involve any physical touching. That to me, I mean, a lot of these men, he's probably in his 80s. They've been living with this as well. And that's not at all to minimize what the young women went through. But this has been a heavy burden for many of the men as well.
I am really glad that you seized on that and pointed that out, because that is something that really stuck out to me as well. Some of these men, as you noted, are in their 80s, and these are incidents that happened when they were teens, and they have stuck with them for that long. And people often talk about a culture that sort of says, okay, boys will be boys, and the degree to which that's really damaging for women and girls, and that's indisputably true. I think what something like this shows is that it's not a good culture for men as well, men and boys as well. You know, a culture that sort of encourages and allows for people to really behave in ways that they of which they later feel ashamed, and I think has real consequences for the people who act in ways that they feel badly about decades later.
And I remember one of the stories is actually from a man who came out as gay a couple of years after the incident that he recounts. And he talks about feeling this tremendous pressure. He took the daughter of a coworker to prom at the mom's asking, and felt like he was supposed to, you know, do this manly thing of you know, being sexually aggressive, and that, especially for him, for someone who he says he never had felt a real physical attraction or physical excitement with girls, even he felt that pressure, that societal pressure.
One of the aspects of some of the stories that we couldn't publish that did stick out to me, and it's unfortunate we couldn't get people to put their names on them to sort of let this facet get aired, is that a lot of the men talked about a culture that really encourages men to keep pushing forward and women to not really take their no's seriously, I guess is the best way to put it. So, you know, a lot of these men described having a sense that women were saying no because they were supposed to say no. The expectation was that they would say no, and that you were supposed to engage in this little dance of, you know, men try to go get as far as they can. They let a woman say no once, you know, try to push forward, let her say no again, you know, try to push forward again, and then maybe if she says it the third time, you know, she really means it. Tom, what he was describing, you know, it was not exactly along those lines, but it kind of echoed some of those descriptions of there's really many men talked about the sort of very strong societal expectations of how they were supposed to be behaving in these encounters, and that, you know, they too were young and they were confused, and they thought that they were doing their thing, and they thought that the women that they were engaged with were doing their thing. So that didn't, unfortunately, we couldn't get enough names attached to those stories to have that make it into the actual piece, but I did think that was really interesting.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Alicia, what is your hope for putting these stories out there? Is there a desire for this to be a catalyst for reflection on the part of men and women?
I guess that my hope would be we can hear a little bit more from men and get a sense that they are reflecting on, you know, what forces drive them to act sexually in ways that they aren't happy about later. We've had about a year, almost to the day, of women talking about their own sexual encounters and the ways that they may have damaged them. And without going too far in conflating, you know, workplace sexual harassment and, you know, teenage behavior, I think that there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, our sexual culture and, you know, the ways that that hasn't been good for women and the ways that it hasn't been good for men, but there hasn't been a ton of participation on the part of men in really talking about this and talking about it in a very personal way. I guess I'm just hoping that this piece can encourage men to sort of talk about their own experiences a little bit to do so maybe even publicly. I wasn't sure what kind of reception this piece would get. I didn't know if people would really sort of lash out against the people who participated. Mm-hmm. And that really didn't happen. Most people said, we're really ready for this step to happen. We want to hear these sides of these stories. And so I think that that's encouraging, and I think it means that we can recognize that when people behave badly sexually, that they might not be personally monsters, but we can't understand the forces that lead people to act in ways that they're ashamed of unless we talk about them. So that's what my hope is, to kind of encourage men to talk about, you know, their sexual encounters and the ones that they aren't happy about or proud of more candidly.
Well, Alicia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
That was Alicia P.Q. Whitmire, gender editor at the New York Times opinion section. She wrote and edited the stories of the piece, Eight Stories of Men's Regret. Judith Sears Poisson talked to her last week. Attorney General Jeff Sessions submitted his letter of resignation to President Trump this week. According to the letter, the president asked for Sessions to step down. The person President Trump has appointed as acting attorney general has come under scrutiny given his public stance on the ongoing investigation by special counsel Robert Mueller into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Our next guest is here to talk about Sessions' replacement and what it could mean for the Mueller probe. Laura Brown is director of the Graduate School of Political Management at the George Washington University. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Certainly. Thanks for having me on, Rob.
A lot of moving parts here. Let's take it one piece at a time. Laura, first of all, the dismissal of Attorney General Jeff Sessions, not entirely unexpected, coming the day after Election Day. What are you making of that?
Well, I think that's right. Many people had the impression from the president that Jeff Sessions would be, in one way or another, removed.
We lost Laura there, or we're not hearing you. Can you hear me, Laura? Okay, we'll have our producer pick up and see if Laura hit the mute key maybe by accident. I don't know. Talking to Laura Brown, director of the Graduate School of Political Management at the George Washington University, looking at the dismissal of Attorney General Jeff Sessions and what comes next. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I think we have Laura back. Laura?
Hello. I'm not sure what happened.
Okay. We'll hope for the best now. But go on with talking about the dismissal of Sessions.
So I was just saying that obviously Sessions being removed from his position wasn't a surprise. The president had signaled that for months, his displeasure with Attorney General Jeff Sessions' decision to recuse himself from the Mueller probe and overseeing it really had created kind of bad blood between the president and Sessions. But I think everyone was surprised at the timing. I mean, this was the time when there was this sense that the Republicans had sort of held off the blue wave with the election. And I think many people assumed that Republicans would be focused on their expanding majority in the U.S. Senate rather than immediately creating sort of questions about what's next with regard to Mueller.
Now, whenever we see a big move like this from the president related at all to the Mueller probe, there's the, okay, what's the next shoe? Is Robert Mueller going to be fired? Do we get in the media, maybe in particular, too hyped up at moments like this?
Well, I do think that everyone is on pins and needles, and I think that is part and parcel of the president's behavior. The president has, to a certain extent, pushed forward kind of a strategy of brinksmanship with regard to a lot of presidential norms. And it makes, I think, most of the public and most of those political analysts fearful about how he plans to use his executive authority next. Usually what we've seen is that the president kind of pushes forward on something or goes past some norm, and then he tends to retreat. And some of that is about, I think, a very real kind of tactic to make the press and the public who are concerned about it look a little foolish and look to be reactionary and a little ridiculous from his perspective.
Now let's take a look at the named acting attorney general, Matthew Whitaker. Now, before we get into him in particular, there are questions as to whether he can be named as acting attorney general, including from John Yoo from the Bush administration, now a law professor, saying constitutionally the president can't do this. What's the argument here?
Well, the argument is that within essentially the appointments clause of the Constitution, which is in Article 2, and what it does is it describes that principal officers of the United States, ambassadors and the like, must be nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate under the advice and consent powers. Principal officers are essentially defined as those individuals who report directly to the president, as a cabinet secretary does, as does the attorney general at the top of the Justice Department. And so the problem here is that Matthew Whitaker has never been confirmed by the Senate to any other position within the Justice Department. He was serving in a chief of staff position, and that was not a Senate-confirmed position. So for the president to kind of elevate him up even to the role of acting is problematic because he's never gone through that level of kind of senior vetting that the other senior officers in the department do.
Talking to Laura Brown from the George Washington University about the dismissal of Attorney General Jeff Sessions and what comes next. Now let's take a look at the career of acting Attorney General, as named by the president, Matthew Whitaker. Also concerns about some of his background in law. Can you talk about what's raising concern?
Well, certainly. I mean, there has been, and the FBI, which now he oversees, is in fact investigating and doing a criminal investigation of a Florida company that had been engaged or alleged to have scammed millions of customers, and Matthew Whitaker had been serving on the advisory board as a paid member at that time. So there is a question about whether he himself knew about or was party to any potential fraud that this company was involved with in Florida. The FBI in Florida is investigating that, and of course, the Attorney General oversees the FBI. Then there's also the political problems, whereby he has been very vocal as a pundit, as a partisan, in having criticized Special Counsel Robert Mueller, criticized the entire Russia investigation, and in addition, he served as a campaign chair for Sam Clovis, who is one of the people who is actually under investigation by Special Counsel Mueller.
So there might be similar expectations to recuse himself from the Mueller probe that led now former Attorney General Sessions to recuse himself?
Yes, one would think that the career sort of ethics attorneys within the Justice Department would recommend, because of all of his connections with these partisan activities, to recuse himself from the investigation. But I think most people believe that the president would not have put him there if he intended to recuse himself. And so there is this kind of problem where we don't imagine that Whitaker's going to recuse himself. We don't imagine that even if the Justice Department career ethics attorneys recommend that he does, that he will follow that guidance as Jeff Sessions did. And there is this other problem where, as the acting interim, if you will, attorney general, he retains all of the powers of the actual attorney general until a new attorney general is appointed and confirmed.
Now, if people believe he was unconstitutionally appointed, is there any kind of mechanism? Is there any kind of procedure for challenging his place in the White House?
Well, this is where it ends up becoming a sort of a larger issue of checks and balances within, you know, our system. So there has been a statement by Chuck Schumer, who is the Senate Minority Leader, saying that he believes that Whitaker is unconstitutional. So whether or not he can attempt to try to get anything done to check Whitaker or to have him removed is pretty unlikely, given that the majority in the Senate is Republican. But certainly he can make that claim and create some pressure. There's also another possibility whereby a sort of future person who is charged with a crime can come back and say that this charge is sort of not valid because the acting attorney general under whom the charge took place is in fact unconstitutionally there and doesn't have the authority to do this. So there are possibilities and remedies. It's just the problem is those things do take time.
We're talking to Laura Brown right now, director of the Graduate School of Political Management at the George Washington University. She's with us to talk about Attorney General Jeff Sessions' resignation and what it might mean for the Russia probe. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the news that Jeff Sessions is out as Attorney General? There's an acting Attorney General, Matt Whitaker, in place. Do you have worries or hopes for what happens next in the Mueller and Russia probe given these changes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll look at the Russia probe coming up in just a few moments here on Central Time. We continue our conversation now about the resignation of Attorney General Jeff Sessions at the request of the president, his temporary replacement, and what the future could hold for Special Counsel Robert Mueller and his investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Laura Brown's with us from the George Washington University. You can join in with your reactions, with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Laura, let's turn now to the Mueller probe. Robert Mueller and his team have, seems like, kept their heads down during the election season. What shoes are we waiting to drop there?
Well, certainly there has been a great deal of kind of speculation and rumors about what is happening with Roger Stone. We know that Roger Stone's attorneys have been sort of talking, and they're with Mueller, and in fact, they were in court when this whole situation with Sessions came down yesterday, on Wednesday, basically having to then explain to the judge how or in what ways it might affect their case going forward. So there are conversations going on. There have been long rumors that Roger Stone could potentially be indicted. There's also been recent reporting about concern about whether or not Donald Trump Jr. had engaged in some form of perjury, and that might then spur some legal indictment. There's also a question about where things go with Michael Cohen and all of the discussions about his sort of relationship to the Stormy Daniels, and now that the Wall Street Journal has reported that the FBI has sort of knowledge that the president was involved in violating these campaign finance laws, there's also questions about how federal prosecutors will handle that.
Let's go to our callers now. Sam is with us in Menominee. Sam, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Sam?
So my question is, if Mathis were to pull funding from the Mueller probe, like he has said he, you know, did was going to do last year, would it be possible for like a private citizen or a private corporation to step in and say, you know what, I'd be willing to fund the probe.
Sam, thanks for the call. And yeah, Matthew Whitaker, now acting attorney general, had said in the past the best solution might be not to end the probe, but to cut funding and basically make it impossible to proceed with the probe. Do you see that potentially happening, Laura? And is there any kind of remedy that private citizens or Congress could take up?
Well, I think it is something that, you know, he may move forward on, given that he has said it. It's possible. We don't know. It's also possible, though, that Congress would find a way to do a carve-out or a special portion of the budget to attempt to fund Mueller's investigation. I mean, at this moment, we do have, you know, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying and expecting that Mueller's probe will move forward. In fact, that is his justification for why he doesn't believe that Mueller needs any sort of special protection. But were we to see, you know, some action taken against Mueller, I imagine that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell would have to go along with a Democratic House to allow for funding and budgeting. A private corporation could not move forward with that. I should mention that the one other thing that could happen is if Special Counsel Mueller kind of ends up leaving the Justice Department in one way or another, either his investigation is ended or he chooses to resign because they are trying to scuttle the investigation, it is always possible that the House Intelligence Committee could essentially then turn around and hire him to continue his work through another fashion.
Thanks for that call, Sam. We'll go next to Gene in Antigo. Gene, hi.
Hey, I want to thank you for taking my call. I understand that, you know, people are upset about you know, Jeff Sessions getting removed from, you know, asking to leave the being the attorney general. But see, I remember about a year ago or so, you know, there was something that Sessions said that made the liberals mad. Now, I want you guys to know, I voted on both sides of the ticket, okay? You know, but I don't understand what the big deal is. As far as Robert Mueller is, Robert Mueller's investigation's been going on forever. I'm not really seeing what he's coming up with. I mean, I understand the Stormy Daniels and his son and stuff, but I don't see where the Russian collusion where Trump directly did anything is coming from. That's all I wanted to say.
Gotcha, Gene. Thanks for the call. A couple points there. I think he was hinting, you know, Democrats, not really big Jeff Sessions fans over the years. Why would they be upset about his departure from the attorney general spot? Tackling that first, Laura.
Well, let me just say, I don't think that the liberals are upset about Jeff Sessions leaving. In fact, he just did something as he was leaving that will once again kind of raise the ire of the Democrats. And that is he essentially changed some of the law enforcement rules that were there in place to curb police violence. So there are going to be civil rights activists that are very upset that sort of on the way out the door, Sessions decided one more time to show that he really isn't somebody who is interested in ensuring the civil rights of all Americans. That being said, what liberals were upset about is that Jeff Sessions did do the ethically right thing with regard to this investigation into Russia and its interference in the election. Sessions knew that he had met with the Russian ambassador, and he recused himself. And for doing that, the president kind of became upset with him and said, you know, that essentially he wasn't there to protect him. And the president doesn't seem to fully fathom that the attorney general works on behalf of the Constitution and the laws of the country, not as a personal attorney for the president. So I think there's a little bit of confusion here that liberals like Jeff Sessions. I don't think they do, and I don't think there are many who would say they did. They just have been worried about the process because Sessions did do the right thing by recusing himself. And this person who's been put in place now that Sessions is gone is an even kind of more partisan loyalist and kind of scary individual for liberals because he doesn't appear to be doing the ethically or morally right thing, which is to recuse himself from overseeing the Mueller investigation.
And Gene's point kind of sets us up for a good topic to go out on. Gene saying Mueller probe going on a long time. What do we have to show for it?
Well, I mean, right now, at the moment, I believe that there are 32 indictments, or guilty pleas of companies and individuals. I mean, that's not a small number of sort of legal actions in an 18-month period of time. It's also true that we do have guilty pleas from Paul Manafort, who was the president's campaign manager. We also have Rick Gates, who was deeply involved in all of the work that he and Paul Manafort were leading on behalf of the president. And, you know, we also have guilty pleas from Michael Flynn, who became the national security advisor, and George Papadopoulos, who was a foreign policy campaign advisor. All of these people had been lying about their Russian contacts, and it is the case that these individuals have either pled guilty or are cooperating in one way with Robert Mueller to sort of bring forward more of what we know down the road.
We'll leave it there, and to be continued. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
Laura Brown is director of the Graduate School of Political Management at the George Washington University. She was with us today to talk about Attorney General Jeff Sessions' forced resignation and what it could mean for the Mueller probe, the Russia probe, in the future. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, state lawmakers are likely to head into a lame duck session with Kimberly Clark subsidies and cuts to the incoming governor's authority both on the table. A Capitol reporter tells us what's at stake. A new report says we can do a lot to boost the quality of our transportation options in urban areas, rural places, and all points in between. One of the authors of that report gives us some of the details. And if you feel witty, oh so witty, our guest can tell you why. Meet the author of Wit's End, What Wit Is, How It Works, and Why We Need It. Plus, we'll take a look at some of the top news stories of the day, that and more. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.